I'll make you all a promise. If you'll all stick with me and work hard, we'll forget about money. Let's get together. We'll make a regular hotel out of this place. I'll put writing paper in the hotel. Next year, if you behave yourself, I'll put in envelopes.
It was his first scene in his first feature film for Paramount, The Coconuts, but the patter is unmistakable. In the following 8 years, he and his brothers would produce some comedy classics, and he would still be pulling in audiences over 40 years later. Here to champion the cause of his nominated comedic great is the documentary filmmaker, writer and criminologist Roger Grafe. Among his 100-odd films, like for instance his award-winning TV series on the Thames Valley Police, he's best known for his pioneering work in filming in hitherto closed institutions. He developed the fly-on-the-wall technique in Britain and gained some of the first access to film inside boardrooms and ministries. And he was media columnist for my own paper, The Times, in the 1990s. His OBE was for services to broadcast journalism. Roger, if there's any doubt left, tell us whom you've chosen as your great life and why.
Well, it's Groucho, which I discovered recently looking at his FBI files was misspelled by the FBI as G-R-A-U-C-H-O. Almost everybody in the world just knew him as Groucho, and he was absolutely inimitable. He was an iconic figure of the 30s, 40s, and to some extent the 50s, in a way that very few people were.
Why was he on the FBI files in the first place?
Well, actually, he seemed to get involved in some quite left-wing causes, and he was like a lot of liberals in Hollywood in those days. They weren't aware that the Communist Party might have been involved, or if they were, they didn't mind. It was actually a rather innocent foray, but he had a social conscience, and it was quite clear from the letters that I've been reading how much of a social conscience he had. He minded about things, and he was willing to take risks and put his name on it.
His career lay entirely in comedy. Yours is more serious, isn't it?
Well, actually, I've done some comedy as well. Like, I started the Amnesty Benefits on television. They'd been put together by John Cleese, and John and I ended up making 9 films together, and I helped Richard Curtis launch Comic Relief. And, you know, I love comedy, actually, absolutely adore it. And if we can do something as serious as launching Amnesty as a brand, which we did with those films, I'm thrilled to have both. You enjoy yourself, and you do something worthwhile.
Also joining us to flesh out the life of Julius Groucho Marx is Glenn Mitchell, author of the Marx Brothers Encyclopedia. Glenn, you're clearly a fan, but where does this claim to greatness lie?
I think Groucho's claim to greatness lies in the fact that he succeeded in life several times over. For the most part, his brothers really succeeded once, maybe twice, but Groucho kept going at either end of the Marx Brothers story. He succeeded in vaudeville with his brothers. Together, they conquered the Broadway stage. Then, of course, they made the famous feature films, which we still see on television. And after that, after quite a few false starts, Groucho became an even bigger celebrity than he was as part of the Marx Brothers, as a solo entity in his quiz show, You Bet Your Life. That, of course, is not even mentioned in the literary achievements.
Let's talk a bit about his early life. Did he come from a privileged background,
no,
Roger?
No, he didn't. It was a working-class Jewish background, sort of sandwiched between Italian and Irish neighbourhoods and German neighbourhoods in the Upper East Side of New York, where I grew up also, but not, I'm afraid to say, I was rather luckier than he was in terms of background. But it was very much immersed in the kind of multicultural scene of New York. And his uncle went on the stage, changed his name and became part of Gallagher and Sheehan, which were a very famous vaudeville act at the time. And his mother was very keen that he should follow in the footsteps. He had a nice singing voice, and they all started off as singers, not very good singers, by the way. So when they found themselves in a disastrous gig in Texas somewhere, they started ad-libbing, and suddenly the audience actually rather liked this, rather better than the singing. So he started to make good, but he certainly did not start with a silver spoon in his mouth.
Was she, Glenn, the archetypal Jewish mother?
Both the archetypal Jewish mother and the archetypal stage mother. Mm. Minnie Marx looked at her brood and realised there wasn't an awful lot that she could do with them. Oddly, the only one who could probably have made serious headway was Groucho, because he was, frankly, hampered by a lack of education and opportunity, and I think would rather have been a doctor, which I'm sure is why later in life, when he signed letters using his character names, he tended to favour Dr. Hackenbush. But that wasn't going to happen, so instead of becoming a physician or an academic, which he would also have liked to have been, Groucho went into vaudeville. And once he started to make some headway, it made sense for the other, frankly, unemployable brothers to be rounded up and put onto the stage with him, particularly, I think, Harpo, who was really drifting. So it was inevitable that this rather strong, shall we say, stage mother was going to create an entity out of her offspring.
How did he get the name Groucho? His real name was Julius.
They were dealt the names in a card game. They were playing cards with a guy called Art Fisher, who did monologues. And apparently he had a tendency to bestow nicknames that would linger. And at this time there was a newspaper strip in the States that was gently making fun of Sherlock Holmes. But it was a cast of monkeys, and they had names ending in O. At least in one walk-on appearance in one of the strips was a character called Groucho, because he was a grouch. And this, I guess, was a name that was doing the rounds for people who were of sour temperament. And Julius Henry Marx really fitted that category.
You said, Glenn, that he was the only one of the brood who looked as though anything much could be made of him. And I've read that Groucho was the bespectacled, scholarly one, the one who was quite good at school. Do you think that that cleverness, the intelligence, his love of reading, informs his performances? Does it come through, Roger?
Well, I think it does, actually, although you have to read quite closely between the lines to see that. I mean, actually, he dropped out of school, by the way, and always regretted that, and was very, very seriously interested in literature. And, you know, there's a wonderful correspondence with him and T.S. Eliot, in which Eliot described him as his pin-up, Eliot calls him. And when they finally meet after a series of false starts, it's a very funny scene in which Groucho has read both King Lear and The Wasteland in order to have small talk with Eliot. Eliot insists on talking about monkey business and other favourite scenes, and it's a very funny notion. But actually also James Joyce quotes Groucho in it. Carl Sandburg, the great American poet, was another admirer and a friend to Thornton Wilder. I mean, he actually saw himself and indeed achieved a certain kind of literary intensity, if you like, and the only way you can see it in his ad-libs and in his comedy is the felicity with which he makes puns that is actually Joycean. I mean, anybody who really knows Joyce or T.S. Eliot can see puns all the way through. And you could actually hear in it sounds like a rather pretentious comparison, but there is actually some surrealist punning that is very, you know, it's classy stuff. It's very, very funny. And he improvised quite a lot of it, although some of it was written for him as well.
Minnie wasn't the archetypal Jewish mother in this sense. She wasn't a particularly warm or loving person, was she?
Well, from what one gathers, no. And actually, Groucho, the impression one has from reading his letters and other accounts of him is that he kind of blew hot and cold as well. I mean, he could be quite nasty. He was always on. It was obviously tough business being married to him. On the other hand, he was obviously a very loving friend, and the correspondence with writers and actors and performers that he admired is really effusive. In fact, it rather prompted me to think that whenever I see a play by somebody I know or don't know, I should write to them, which is what he did.
Things seem to have gone wrong in relationships with women right from the start, Glenn.
Yes, I think that's fair. In some respects, it was very difficult, I think, for the Marx brothers to find a woman who could compare with Minnie, because she was such a strong presence, even if, as you've pointed out, Groucho was, by implication, not necessarily the favourite. I mean, Chico, being the eldest surviving infant, despite his bad behaviour, was Minnie's favourite. Harpo came a very close second. By the time Groucho had appeared, you know, the maternal allocation was starting to dwindle somewhat. So Groucho didn't get the best deal. But nevertheless, the problem, I think, was always finding a woman who could follow Minnie. When Harpo eventually married, he felt he'd at last found the right person who could be the new Minnie, in a sense.
He was happily married, though, wasn't he?
He was very happily married, possibly because he had the wisdom to leave it relatively late in life. He had his flirtations and some engagements, but didn't tie the knot until his late 40s, and it endured. So perhaps that was the key to a Marx Brothers marriage. But Groucho, yes, did have problems, I think, in maintaining a proper relationship, in the sense that what he wanted wasn't necessarily what his wife wanted or what either was able to deliver.
There's an interesting discrepancy between the kind of girl chasing that goes on in the movies and Groucho's own account of what he's like and how girls turned him down all the time. And he actually, there's a lot of sort of jokey, macho chat about, you know, and lots of quips about chasing women. Anybody who says he can see through a woman is missing a great deal, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, he quietly says to his friends, actually, he's left alone. He went and stayed at the Waldorf, for example, instead of the Plaza, because he would see a woman on his way to bed not with her, I hasten to add, but just the sight of a woman going to his lonely bed was enough to comfort him. I mean, it's rather sad, his relationship with women, I think.
That parallels something which one of his friends said, I think it was Norman Krasner, the writer, who, when pressed, said that he felt that really Groucho only wanted a wife with whom to have dinner. He didn't want the rest of it necessarily, just couldn't face being alone of an evening. And what he wanted was a domestic life for all the wild antics professionally. He wanted to be at home, fire and slippers, that sort of thing. But the wives, of course, by contrast, wanted a social life. The first wife, Ruth, finished up spending more and more time at the tennis club, not least because she was tired of listening to Groucho's Gilbert and Sullivan collection every night, which drove her crazy. He was the one of all the brothers who wanted the most to have that settled domestic existence, and he was the one who obtained it the least.
There is a famous tradition of clowns who want to play Hamlet, and I think Groucho was actually in that to some extent, because not only did he like and aspire to literature, but also he did one straight play and occasionally tiny little walk-ons in parts. He did one called Time for Elizabeth, and you know, he just loved not playing Groucho with a moustache and you know, the funny walk. But actually the critics went for him whenever he did this, and he really felt trapped in the caricature that he'd created, which is sad.
How, Glenn, did the Groucho with a funny moustache and the funny walk start? How did that act first get on the road, the three of them together?
They started out playing ethnic types, which was quite common in vaudeville at that time. Harpo was playing what they called a Patsy Brannigan character, which was a kind of ignorant yokel type with perhaps a hint of Irish in the surname, hence the rather tatty red wig made out of rope. Chico, as we know, was playing an Italian stereotype. Gummo, the younger brother, was playing what was known as a Hebrew boy, who was a cocky kid. Mm. And he'd be in the school act sassing the teacher, who was played by Groucho. And Groucho was playing originally a German stereotype, because they had that upbringing. They were essentially German-Jewish family in America, and Groucho played a German type with a thick, as they call it, their Dutch accent, which he had to drop. They had the interesting timing of being in Canada when the Lusitania went down, and if Groucho had gone on doing German, they'd have murdered him. So he did a quick switch to a Jewish characterisation.
I think what's interesting also about American culture during that period onwards is how strong the influence of Jewish culture actually was, because all sorts of people that I knew who weren't at all Jewish would make jokes in Yiddish. All the sort of language was there. The success of Woody Allen since then is very clear. And that's sort of, it's a Jewish temperament that has nothing to do with religion. It's a kind of cultural mindset. In Europe, we see it in the Czechs, you know, this kind of use of comedy to survive. So it's really not much to do with their background specifically, I think, as just penetrating the culture. And that's one of the reasons I think he's so important, because he stood for the quintessence of that kind of wisecracking insight, saying the impossible, but saying it with enormous style and challenging people in a kind of provocative but intelligent way. So it's not just about, you know, his background, which is kind of ethnically precise. It's much more to do with how America's a melting pot, absorbed this stuff, and then put that kind of humour all across the nation's airwaves, which at a time in the country was actually rather anti-Semitic.
I guess a lot of people wouldn't realise that these three actually started their career on the stage and stayed on the stage for quite a long time. Is that important to the subsequent?
It's very important, because they improvised a lot. And, you know, they were really confident as live performers. And I remember when I was young, growing up, seeing this stuff and just absolutely adoring it. I mean, I had a nanny who used to take me there when I was 8 onwards. That's when I started watching the films. And she was Irish, by the way. And simply, I never stopped laughing. And I still, seeing them again for this broadcast, I just roll around. And fortunately, my children love it too. So that, in that sense, that is wonderful. But actually, the way they performed quite a lot of the time drove the directors mad, because in the end they would have to simply set up the camera and let these guys go crazy in front of the camera, which came from their theatrical background. They wouldn't have been able to do that kind of improvisation if they didn't have it.
Of course, later on, once they were making films at MGM for Irving Thalberg, he actively encouraged them to take the comedy scenes on the road prior to filming. This was in part to facilitate the timing, because they had to allow for the duration of an audience laugh, which is why those MGMs are a bit slow on TV, because they have these built-in pauses. But above all, so that they could refine the material. As with the Broadway plays, what they began with bore very little resemblance to what finished up on film, because they would throw out lines that didn't work, that ad-lib, and generally polish, refine and hone these scenes so that they could get a good result. But an awful lot, therefore, of what finished up on screen was the Marx Brothers' own interpolations.
I mean, I wouldn't dream to make a serious comparison at one level, but you can still see it if those of the listeners who've seen The Secret Policeman's Ball and those others, is that we were filming a live performance of great comedians, and John Cleese and Michael Palin doing the parrot sketch. Mm-hmm. Michael, in the 25th anniversary of the film, which the BBC asked us to make, says that the scene was never better. And we were using close-ups, catching the excitement, the vibrancy of John and Michael's reactions in a way that you wouldn't normally do. And in the stage, obviously, you wouldn't see close-ups. But in the normal television, you'd just be in a wide shot, so you wouldn't get that. And so the excitement of the live improvisations in the Marx Brothers movies scares the technicians, and it scares the other actors. And you can kind of feel that. It's a bit of vibrancy that gives an extra electric quality to it. And the most famous example, of course, is Margaret Dumont, who famously, according to Groucho, and I'd be interested to know what Glenn thinks, was said never to get the jokes, that he was endlessly teased, but didn't quite see why it was funny. Which, if that's true, was wonderful, because it just meant that there was all this kind of teasing going on, live, as it were.
I think she got more of the jokes than she let on. It's my personal theory that she actually managed to pull the wool over Groucho's eyes for 40 years, because...
Wonderful. I hope so.
I think mostly what happened was that she would still find it shocking. She knew what to expect to some degree, but she still couldn't quite adjust to the way she was treated. And they could always throw her what's known in the States as a curveball.
Well, my favourite one, actually, is at the end of, I think, A Day at the Circus or A Day at the Races, where they're having a dinner party, a grand dinner, and she's asking Dr. Quackenbush if it's really to sit on her right hand and somebody else to sit on her left hand, and he says, "How are you going to eat your dinner?"
Margaret Dumont was the stately, matronly foil for many Marx Brothers routines. In fact, she was his most consistent leading lady, both on stage and screen. Here's a typical encounter from The Coconuts.
Oh, but I love you. I love you. Can't you see how I'm pining for you?
What in the world is the matter with you?
Oh, I'm not myself tonight. I don't know who I am. One false move and I'm yours. I love you. I love you anyhow.
I don't think you'd love me if I were poor.
I might, but I keep my mouth shut.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, the documentary and filmmaker Roger Grafe, has chosen Groucho Marx. And our studio expert is Glenn Mitchell, the author of the Marx Brothers Encyclopedia. We've started talking, almost without knowing it, about the three, Groucho, Harpo, Chico, but you've actually chosen Groucho. Couldn't I protest that essentially their life or their achievement is a tripartite one and you can't separate one from the other two?
It's perfectly true that as a trio they achieved a great deal and the madness was very much expressed by the other two. But not only did Groucho go on to do this radio program and TV program, You Bet Your Life, which went on for years afterwards, but also I think the iconic nature of his wit was something that penetrated, as we talked about T.S. Eliot and others, in a way that probably the others would have been. They would be supporting roles in real support, not just marginal, absolute real support. But he was the first among equals, I'd say.
Before our discussion, I've been talking to one or two people about Groucho, and there are very sharply different views. Some people think the work is evergreen and dating very well. Others that it doesn't really work properly any longer with modern audiences. What would you say, Glenn?
The work is variable. They knew it themselves, particularly as the 30s wore on into the 40s. They knew that MGM weren't so interested in them as they had been when Irving Thalberg, the producer, was alive. They knew that they had other fish to fry, and perhaps the thing was getting a bit stale. I mean, they announced their retirement as an act in 1941. They'd obviously had a good look at the big store and decided to call it quits. So they went their separate ways. Harpo was fortunate enough to be very rich because he hadn't gambled all his money away like Chico did. Chico went on the road with a band for a while. His singer was Mel Torme as a young man, but it was a popular band. And Groucho, again, was financially okay, despite the fact that he had alimony to pay, unlike Harpo. But he had the drive, and I think this also takes us back to why Groucho was the continuing element in the Marx Brothers. He was the one who had the drive to succeed, to get the applause, to get the acclamation. Harpo could have drifted through life quite happily without that. Chico had other interests, but Groucho was the one who needed the acclamation, perhaps because he didn't get that much approval from his mother, I don't know.
There's a wonderful line, actually, from Godard, who said that je suis marxiste de la tendance groucho, grouchiste. And, yeah. You know, I'm a Marxist of the groucho tendency. And that was in the 60s. I mean, that, the point was that by then, even to sophisticated French intellectuals, he was the one. They didn't say chico, you know, the tendance chico-esque or whatever.
Because Groucho was still there. He was still a presence. He was in movies. He did that rather unfortunate picture that Otto Preminger made, Skidoo, playing a gang boss called God. But let's perhaps not dwell on that. But he came over to this country in 64 and 5 to do some television.
He bombed.
Yeah, sadly. Nice try, but no cigar.
You'd agree, Glenn, that if we had to pick one from the three, it would be Groucho, and that you can't imagine the other two without him.
It's difficult to imagine them without him, because although they would turn up as guests in films, television and so on, the one who could function as a solo unit was Groucho. Hence the success of You Bet Your Life. He just had to be a slightly magnified version of his off-screen self to do that, but he was still self-contained. Harpo, working mute, really needed somebody to interact with. He couldn't just walk on and do things.
He couldn't really do much in the way of ad-libbing if he didn't talk. Whereas Groucho's, one of my favourites of his quiz programme was when a woman froze completely on the air and he grabbed her wrist and looked at his watch and said, either you're dead or my watch is stopped. And he was. That's what that was based on, his improvisations and his wit. And it was wonderful. And people just tuned in huge numbers. It was one of the most popular shows on American television.
It made Groucho more famous and far richer than being a Marx brother had done. That's how successful it was. And of course we don't know that so much in this country because it didn't really air it over here. Mention Groucho to people in the States and they'll probably think of You Bet Your Life before they think of the Marx brothers.
Tell me a bit, Roger, about Groucho as a writer, because he wasn't just performing and ad-libbing.
Well, he has that same kind of sarcastic tone, and a lot of... S.J. Perelman is another hero of mine, and it's not an accident that he wrote some of those scripts. In fact, Groucho told him when he came out to Hollywood, because I used to go out with Perelman's daughter, and I actually heard this story directly from him. He said when Perelman arrived, Groucho said to him, the way to identify a baddie is to have him get off the stagecoach and kick a dog. And so that was the kind of writing that, you know, there was always these kind of cracks in his writing. That it is wonderfully fluent, but also surreal. And the opening of Horse Feathers is a gem, absolute classic of nonsense and madness. And it would be lovely if we could hear that.
Oh, sometimes I think I must go mad. Where will it all end? What is it getting you? Why don't you go home to your wife? I'll tell you what, I'll go home to your wife, and outside of the improvements, you'll never know the difference. Pull over to the side of the road there, and let me see your marriage license.
That's from Horse Feathers. Perhaps Groucho's greatest contribution to literature was his letters, in some sort of faint echo of the fact that it was dialogue and quickfire on stage that worked best for him, not so much books as correspondence seemed to work well for him. The famous series of correspondence was with Warner Brothers, who'd supposedly threatened legal action over the making of a Casablanca spoof called A Night in Casablanca, starring Humphrey Bogus, and lo and behold. This is his third attempt to explain the picture to Warners, after which they stopped writing to him. Dear Brothers, since I last wrote you, I regret to say that there have been some changes in the plot of our new picture, A Night in Casablanca. In the new version, I play Bordello, the sweetheart of Humphrey Bogart. Harpo and Chico are itinerant rug peddlers who are weary of laying rugs and enter a monastery just for a lark. This is a good joke on them, as there hasn't been a lark in the place for 15 years. Most of the time, though, Groucho's letter writing was serious, wasn't it?
Well, it varies. I mean, there's a sort of jokey tone. Sometimes he ends a serious letter with a jokey quip. But I think that the man that comes through is serious and is affectionate and thoughtful and also very touchy about criticism that isn't to his liking. I mean, he's willing to admit himself when he's made a bad film or a bad play, but he doesn't like other people doing that. And his affection and his loyalty to some of his really good friends, and some of these were the very funniest people in American television and writing and films. Goodman Ace, for example, people in this country wouldn't have known, but was an absolute seminal figure in 40s and 50s American radio and television. That kind of person, Harry Krasner, Harry Ruby, the songwriter, and so on. And the correspondence is so friendly and saying, you must come and stay, and I'm really missing you, and describes actually rather solitary life, where he wanders down to the country club and has to watch his son play tennis in various parts of the world after that. But he does feel rather wistful. It's quite a touching experience.
In 1941, Glenn, the three brothers go their separate ways. Have they in their personal lives been getting on okay?
There was always a strong bond between the Marx brothers, a genuine fraternal bond. And yes, that was unbreakable. I think the strain that existed between them as brothers often concerned the problem that was Chico, because he was a compulsive gambler. The money was just disappearing, he'd have gangsters after him, and I honestly believe that a lot of the later Marx Brothers pictures would never have been made if he hadn't needed the money. And, of course, that naturally plays quite a bit of strain on their relationship, because they were doing things that they wouldn't have wanted to do otherwise. They were having to look after him. He was being given an allowance. His salary would be held back, and they'd give him so much to live on, so he wouldn't blow it all, but somehow he would always manage to inveigle his way into getting an advance and an advance and advance. So that really was a responsibility that the other brothers shouldn't have had to bear, I think. And that was the main tension.
A friend of mine described the Marx brothers as the missing link between vaudeville and the goons.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the goons I absolutely adored. I didn't grow up in this country, and therefore I missed it. And when I came over and started listening to Spike Milligan particularly, but also heard then the radio programs, The Goons, I saw a seamless connection, because the insanity also made a curious kind of crazy sense. And it's that particular mix of madness and sense that they both shared.
Groucho was with his fourth partner when he died of pneumonia on August the 19th, 1977, aged 86. Intelligent, gifted, acerbic, very funny, yes. But would he himself have thought, as he lay there dying, that he had lived a great life, do you think, Roger?
Well, there are two remarks that I'd like to leave the listeners with. One is Charles Lamb's observation that anybody who doesn't like puns is a mean-tempered man. And so I say that about people who don't like his dialogue. But the other is a scene that the late John Wells, the wonderful comic writer himself, told me. He was directing a cigar commercial here with Groucho, and he said to Groucho, look, you've got to have the cigar in your mouth as you come out the door, turn right towards the camera, hit the mark, take the cigar out of your mouth, and utter the line. So Groucho keeps the cigar in his mouth, turns left, and then realizes the camera is there, turns back, misses the line, keeps the cigar in his mouth, and gets the line wrong. And John said, I'm sorry, Groucho, I think we're going to have to do that again. And he said, what? And tamper with perfection?
My thanks to Roger Grafe and Glenn Mitchell. And I leave the last word to the man himself, Groucho Marx, recorded in conversation with Frank Muir in 1972. Goodbye.
Is there an award you particularly like to get?
No, I think the award that I like is the fact that I wrote one book that is in the Congressional Library in Washington. That I'm proud of. Since I had no schooling, whatever I learned, I picked up by reading. And I think to have a book with no college education, no high school education, no education of any kind, except what I taught myself. And I'm proud of having the book in the Congressional Library in Washington.
And that's a pretty good thing to settle for.
I settled for that.